Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is AppSats Radio, help for partners after sexual betrayal. We talk about it here.
Betrayal trauma.
We are AppSat certified clinical partner specialists and coaches who have been trained to help navigate you through this crisis. There is nothing we won't talk about.
So I've got Amy on the line. Amy, welcome to the show. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about what healthy sexuality looks like when a sex addict is in recovery.
One of the things we know about research and sex addicts is that they don't necessarily want sex with their own wife. And so to me, that says he's in really good recovery because he does want that with you. He has been 2 years sober. He has been in 3 facilities. And I suspect that's how he's wanting closeness with you.
And I do too. And you know what? So many women who've been betrayed make the choice not to end up with a partner. I was talking with a woman today who said, my husband and I have been apart for over a year, and the thought of him moving back in and me I'm sorry, I just kind of turned that down because I have a lawnmower right outside my window. Okay, so she said the thought of me living with him again, living with somebody who abused her, who broke her trust, who violated their very basic boundaries with each other, was too frightening for her. And I could absolutely 100% understand how that would be triggering and frightening and, you know, just not at all partner wants to deal with. And so what I want to say to you is you have to be able to stand up and define what it is that you are going to believe is in your best best interest, right? You need to know what that is. And that can be really hard because, again, when you're in that first stage of right after discovery, you can say to yourself, you know what? I can't think. I don't know. I have no idea what I want and what I don't want. Well, then write down your thoughts. It's one of the best ways to reevaluate when you are thinking a little bit more clearly. We can't say it enough on this show that you have been traumatized, and we are partner-sensitive clinicians and coaches that want you to heal. And if you're just waiting on your husband to get healthy, then your happiness and your mental health is dependent on him. And that doesn't fly. That is not healthy, that good. You have to be able to do that for yourself. Now, maybe you had great self-esteem prior to the betrayal. Maybe it was average, or maybe it was not where you really wanted it to be. So, of course, partner betrayal takes such a hit on that. I know it. I work with it every day. I see it. But I also see partners that are incredibly strong, that know what they want. They just need a support group, a support person to make that happen. So, as you continue on with your journey, I wonder, how do you view yourself? What would you say about your self-esteem? And just remember, don't feel like you have to be defined by it. Don't feel like you have to be defined by the partner betrayal that occurred that has lowered perhaps your self-esteem. I've said it a zillion times that all spiritual paths start out with great, great suffering. And then it's up to you to turn that into transformation. I don't want this to happen to you. I'm sorry it happened to you. I would never wish it to happen to you. But the truth of the matter is, it has happened to you, and now it's time for you to figure out a way to get back up and create more strength from it. We call that self-actualization. And as a coach working with people that have not been through trauma, I want to help them get to that next level called self-actualization, where they feel like they're running on all cylinders and they're doing what they were really meant to do in their life. Sound good, right? You know, you would never have asked for this trauma, but since it's happened to you, I want to know, how might you be stronger? Our guest today, Gary Owens, is a male partner, and he's going to talk about how he had to get stronger with very little support and what he did and how he wants to help others. He actually wrote a book, an e-book, called Betrayed Husband's Survival Guide. And he does believe that there are some major differences between female partners and male partners. Now, what grade would you give yourself on being gentle with yourself? Right? The number one issue that anybody and everybody deals with is, I am not good enough. And when they feel like they're not good enough, they often begin to question everything they've been through and how they might have fed into it. And I don't want you to do that. I want you to 100% know that you are good enough. And if you want to get better, you know, if you want to go back to school, if you want to work on anger management, if you want to lose 50 pounds, if you want to build muscle, if you want to practice mindfulness so that you'll be happier and healthier, well, good for you. But you really are a child of God, and you are exactly who you're supposed to be today. Now let's move you away from what has happened to you today. And so hopefully you had a good childhood. You had parents that loved you and affirmed you and made you realize that you were unique and special just because you were you. People that I work with, and let's face it, I know I work with a skewed population. People don't typically come in and see me unless there's something they want to change about themselves. Most people have received some negative messages. You know, they have been discouraged by important people in their lives. Or worse than that, they've been neglected. You know, great and wise professionals, psychologists, say that neglect is sometimes worse than abuse. So I'm going to ask you, who was your number one support person in your life, and who was your most discouraging person in your childhood? Think about that for a minute. Again, as a coach and a mental health therapist of over four decades, I am a real believer in creating a family of choice. And what that means is when you can create a family of people who love you, who are supportive, who are positive and encouraging, there's never enough of that around. And one of the tests I took today, what was that test I took? It was on attachment, and I thought, I'm going to just take this test. Because I know that Patrick Karn says that most sex addicts come from disengaged, neglectful families. And although I'm not a sex addict, nor a partner, I came from a family that was pretty consumed with problematic issues in their life. And so I don't remember getting a lot of encouragement. I get it now, but I don't remember it then. And so on attachment to see where did I fall short and where was I grounded and solid. And what it said about me is that because I am so self-reliant, at 20 years of age, I wanted to build out my attic, and I got a friend who was very good at remodeling, and I said, teach me the ropes. Well, I only did that for one house because what I decided was that was not my thing. Not only was it not my thing, but I wasn't very good at it. And I'm kind of a person that really wants to be good at something if I'm going to continue it. But you get the gist. I didn't want to pay to have it done. I wanted to learn how to do it myself. I was sure hoping I'd be really good at it. And so that's what I did. And that self-reliance is a skill, and it's a gift, but it's also a curse in that it probably prevents me, no, it doesn't probably, it prevents me from asking to have my needs met. And one of the questions it asked was, do you ask for your husband to pray for you? And I thought, you know what? I have never asked for anybody to pray for me, let alone him. And I thought, what a cool exercise. I'm going to ask for him to pray for me. And then I'm always thinking about you. And so I said to myself, I wonder in what stage of partner betrayal could the partner feel good enough and safe enough to ask for their husband to pray for them. Right? And so, is that something you could do? Do you ask for other people to pray for you or to have good thoughts for you or to share some of your issues so that they can send you positive energy? Now, this is kind of a dicey subject because the truth of the matter is we teach in AFSAP that you have to be very careful who you share information with, you know, whether that be your family or your friends, because they have to be able to hold your confidence. And so I'm going to leave you with that question. Who could you trust, and who would you be willing to receive help from? You've heard me say before, it's a coaching principle, go in for the big ask. Well, who is that person in your life? Now, I know I have Gary Owens on the line, and he actually has some really strong beliefs about the differences and the similarities between male partners and female partners. And he wants to talk about a story, and he wants to share what is different. And as a result, he has taken his life to the next level by writing a book, Betrayed Husband Survival Guide. And that's an ebook, so anybody can get that anytime. So, Gary, I want to welcome you to Betrayal Recovery Radio. You've got such an interesting story.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, it's one of those things when you say, well, it's an interesting story. It's one I never thought I'd have. Definitely never thought I'd write a book about it. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, absolutely, and you really did take your life to the next level by being able to write that book. You knew that that's what you needed to read when this was happening to you, and then you knew that other men would benefit from that also. So can you tell our listening audience a little bit about your story?
Well, you know, one of the chapters, I titled it When Barbie Met Ken, because we actually met at a Bible college. I was training to be a pastor, and we just looked like the perfect couple. You know, she was incredibly gorgeous. I had the humor side, so that's how I got her. But, you know, I knew some of the things from her past, but I didn't know that they were considered trauma. She didn't even realize that they were trauma. She, when we got married, she had lived in 21 houses in 21 years. And being a pastor's kid, it was always being the new girl, coming into a school year right in the middle, always being expected to be perfect, repressing any type of sexuality, trying to be the good girl. And, you know, when I met her, I just thought, oh, this girl has really high moral standards, and this girl was raised in a pastor's home, and everything's great. And it wasn't until after we were married, and honestly, it was the sexual repression. It was the frigidity. But again, I thought, okay, well, you know, we were both virgins, so I just assumed this was maybe what it was supposed to be like, and didn't think anything about it on that side. So for us, you know, people from the outside would have said, well, you guys look like a happy family. You got three kids, and you know, you've got the decent house, decent living, but, you know, internally there was frustration with each other. And, you know, we used to talk about this, that she would never cry. And again, I thought, well, she's just this brilliant math person. She's logical. I'm kind of the artsy person. So this is just the way things are supposed to be. Which is a really sad thing to say, that if you don't have any experience with what marriage is supposed to be like and what it's supposed to look like, you just kind of assume, well, this is the way it is for everybody. And that was the beginning of our story.
And, so, you know, I get that. And what I know is all marriages are trial and error, and most people have not been given good information about marriage. It's kind of the same thing as parenting. It's all trial and error. But certainly the expectations that were placed on her put her at risk to reject those or to create a double life or whatever. So tell me a little bit about when you noticed that something was really very wrong.
Yeah. Okay. So here was a woman that, like, impeccable. It's such high morals. And then she got a job working with college students. And she got a cell phone. And so I'm one of these people that I'm like, I wish cell phones had never been invented. But she got the cell phone, and she was a type, her students loved her. I mean, she was a college professor. Her students loved her. And I just thought, well, yeah, of course. She's, you know, outgoing. She's fun-loving. She's just this great personality, funny, you know, life of the party. And so I didn't think anything about, oh, her students are texting her, asking her about math and stuff. And our neighbor said to me, you know, she's acting like a teenager. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, well, she's texting people like she's their peer. And what I realized later, you know, once we all unpacked things in counseling and stuff like that, was she hadn't been able to live an adolescence. And so she was now living this adolescence and getting all the attention that she never got when she was having to be the perfect kid or the new kid. So she was having all these experiences that I had had when I was an adolescent. And, you know, those needs had been met for me when I was a teenager, but she had never had those needs met. She had never had that somebody's pursuing me and somebody loves me and somebody's feeding me the lines. And it was just that perfect storm. And so there were students that started pursuing her, and she didn't act on it outside of the flirtation. Well, that school closed down. It was a business school. And when it closed down, all the pursuit and all the we love you and the affirmation, it disappeared overnight. And those students started saying, hey, I always thought you were beautiful. I always liked you. I always imagined what it would be like to be with you. While these now the ethical barriers were gone, and it was just two people, and that kind of began to snowball. And then she started a new business venture, and men started it's almost like they have a sixth sense or something, that they could see, here's a woman who needs to be loved and wanted and pursued, and we're going to slide in and do that. And it was just things began to feel odd, but I didn't have any proof. And you can't accuse somebody on a feeling that you have.
Yeah, and I agree with you. It's almost like when somebody is really needy, there will always be people that will take advantage of that or will figure out a way to have it meet their own needs. So here she is. She's getting all these accolades, all this attention. And was the first incident of realizing this may be extreme when your friend did say she acts like a teenager?
Yeah, that's when I was like, something's off. This is just weird. Why is she acting this way? And, you know, the explosion, the D-Day, the discovery day for me is we were laying in bed. We had a shared Dropbox account, and both of our phones would automatically upload photos. Well, she had a screenshot of a text message, and I came to find out she had screenshotted the text message to send to another guy to kind of get him hooked in and go, look, this other person's pursuing me sexually and see what's happening over here. And it just so happened, it was one of those, you know, one in a million chances that I had my Dropbox open just as that photo got uploaded. I tapped on it, I looked at it, and I showed it to her, and I said, what's this? And immediately she grabbed at the phone to try to take it away and said, oh, that's one of my students. I'm helping her. And you know how you can tell someone's voice by the way they text? It's just they have a certain style, a certain way they write and things, and I said, this sounds like you. And she's like, no, it wasn't me. And I'm like, no, this is you. And she still wouldn't admit it. Well, we actually had a marriage counseling session already scheduled for the next morning. So we got there, and she confessed that she had gone out of town under the guise of wanting to go to a concert, and that she had actually had a one-night stand with this guy that she had been flirting with. They had met at a conference, and then the gates started to open that, well, I've been sending photos, and I've been sexting with other people. All I felt was the distance. I knew something wasn't right between us, and something wasn't right with her, but this was the first time that I was staring at truth and now confronted with truth. And I think I did what probably a lot of affair partners do. I went into detective mode.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so as you did that, did you find more and more evidence that she had been acting out for a while?
Yep, because I went to the phone records, and I saw, even though I couldn't tell who they were being sent to, I was then, detective mode, I started saying, okay, let me look at this phone number and do a reverse phone number search, and why are there 3,000 texts to this one guy in a month, and why is the guy that she just confessed that she had this one night, why is she still texting him after she's confessed? And that was one of those moments that I just went, this is insane. And then started, well, I won't say exactly what I did because there's no reason to give people ways to do things, but I started tracking down going, oh, okay, I know who this person is now, and I know who this person is, and started making lists and screenshots and, you know, obsessing over everything I could find, every detail. Where did they work? You know, how did they find each other? And what were they sharing? And it drove me crazy.
Well, you know, you call that the detective mode, and absolutely it is. But you were trying to put the puzzle pieces together to say, how bad is it? And what don't I know? And those are two huge partner questions that any man or woman would ask. So as you do the detective work and you try to put things together, did you have an experience that so many women do? And that is their brain feels foggy, like it's kind of gone offline, and it's actually a trauma response. Because this is the utmost in rejection. Did you feel that your brain was not functioning on all cylinders?
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be honest, there are times today that I will say, is this the result of the trauma? You know, that I don't have the drive that I used to have, or I don't have the creativity that I used to have, because I felt like I was a pretty high-functioning individual, but I remember I came into work and somebody said, hey, are you okay? Are you sick? And I just had to go with it. I was like, yeah, I'm really not feeling well. And because I was going through the motions, I was playing the role that everyone knew me as, but I wasn't doing as good of a job as I thought I was. But yeah, there was this definite fog. I remember thinking, there will never be a day that I don't think about this. Now, the day has come. I can go days without thinking about what she did or that experience. So it's not as in the front of the mind 24/7 like it used to be. The panic attacks, the depression, the anxiety. I didn't think I was going to make it. I literally thought I'm done. I'm gone. I can't exist as a human being. I remember saying I've never made as many mistakes as I made during that first year of discovery. Mm-hmm. And I, for a person that really prided themselves on being detail oriented, I felt like I had lost part of who I was. Because
right.
Part of my mind was somewhere else.
Well, of course. And so, Gary, who did you have to talk to? How did you cope with this? Who were your supports?
Well, the first one was I was already seeing a counselor for my own issues, and then we were seeing a counselor together. And the funny thing is the first marriage counselor was just a marriage counselor, and I don't mean just, in the sense of not a specialist. She wasn't a CSAT or anything. So the very first meeting we had with the marriage counselor, her eyes got really big because my wife said, he doesn't want to have sex as much as I want to. I could stay in bed all day and just have sex all day. And I just kind of looked at the counselor, kind of put my hands out in exasperation and opened my eyes real big, like, this isn't normal. This is not normal. And she kind of did the same thing. So to be honest, she was not a good help for us, but I was, my other personal counselor was, and said something that scared me, but really helped me. And she said, "Hey, do you know what bipolar is?" And I was like, "Well, you know, I've kind of heard of it in the jokes and everything, but not really." And so she helped me, because she felt like, "Hey, there's something undiagnosed going on here, possibly." And then she also referred me to a CSAT once my wife was diagnosed with a sexual addiction. So I had a very good counselor, and then had a very good CSAT that was helping me. I had two very close friends from high school, and in our group text, we call each other friendship anchors, and that's what I called one of the chapters of my book, because these guys were reality. Now, the limitation to them is, I remember when I first told the one guy, he said, "Well, let me ask you, have you been taking care of her? Have you been dating your wife? Have you come home on time? You know, do you help around the house?" It hurt because he didn't know any better. You know, that was the type of advice that people give when they find out, you know, your spouse is cheated. But I was like, "Dude, I'm doing all this stuff. I'm like, I'm taking her out on dates. I'm being thoughtful. I clean the house. I do the dishes. I do most of the cooking. I'm like, this is not my fault. This is not my fault, you know?" So I had those two close friends.
And, you know, you're right. They were doing very best they could. But I got to tell you, her sex addiction had nothing to do with whether you were taking her out on dates or how many times she was having sex with you or the conflict that you might have had, because sex addiction is a brain issue for the person that has sex addiction. It's not about the relationship. It just affects the relationship, right?
Yeah. Well, I remember one time we were having this discussion in the car, actually on our way to Celebrate Recovery, a 12-step program. And she said, "You know, if your anger drives me back to these guys." And I just said, How come my anger doesn't drive you deeper into recovery? Why doesn't my anger drive you to talk to your female friends? Why doesn't my anger drive you to positive things?" I said, "It's because you don't want the positive things. You want your addiction." I said, "So don't blame this on me." And it was like, that was one of those moments where I'd had enough recovery tools that I stood up for myself and said, "No, that's gaslighting. That's trying to pin your addiction on me. I'm not going to take your garbage. You need to deal with that. So I'm going to do my stuff. I'm going to stay on my side of the street. Yes, I'm angry. I think there's a reason to be angry, but I'm not going to take responsibility for your actions. You have to take responsibility for that."
And so you definitely did assertiveness, and you did it really, really well. Did you get the feeling that she wanted to heal from her own sex addiction?
No. No, I didn't. I think there were two things going on, the bipolar and the sex addiction. And so the bipolar had caused this hypermania, hypersexuality. But then you had this underlying addiction of, "Please love me, please pursue me, you know, please want me." Because a lot of her acting out, you know, when you read some of Patrick Carnes' descriptions of behavior, and I'm like, well, you know, my wife wasn't seeing prostitutes or, you know, male escorts, and she wasn't watching porn, and she wasn't doing this and this and this. So much of hers was that romance, that tell me I'm worth something, tell me I'm good, tell me I'm loved. But the only way she knew how to get that was, well, if I'm sexual, the guys respond to that. So I would say here were one turning point. One turning point was when she left the first psychiatrist, went to a second psychiatrist that specialized in addictions. And that psychiatrist was like, I don't know what your other person was doing, but let's beat this. Let's beat the bipolar. Once her sanity came back, I felt like she was better equipped to deal with the addiction. So it was almost like trying to repair the car while it was moving type thing. So once the bipolar became a little bit more manageable, that's when light bulbs started going off. And she saw this second psychiatrist was also the week that she had gone into full-blown mania and addiction with her primary affair partner, and which I discovered when later that week. And that was a rough summer because she was trying to deal with the bipolar and the addiction for the first time in a year and a half. So when I say no, yeah, I think the first year and a half of the discovery was, I'm really sad that I got caught. I'm really sad that I keep getting caught. I'm really sad that I keep hurting you, but I'm not sad enough, or it doesn't hurt enough, or I'm not rock bottom enough to really get serious about this. So I will say the other thing is I was the perfect enabler. I was going to hide everything from our children that lived at home. I didn't want them to hurt. I was trying to protect them, and I thought, well, I'm protecting them by pretending everything's fine. And it wasn't until we separated and I told them not everything that had happened. I just simply said, your mother chose to go outside of our relationship, our marriage, for male companionship. So they were old enough that they could fill in some blanks. They were old enough that they knew things weren't right. They were old enough that they knew mom wasn't right. But I didn't feel it was my job to fill in all those blanks for them.
Well, you're exactly right. And you don't want to do extra damage to their brains about their mother. They'll ask the questions that they need to know. And so I appreciate the fact that you did a good job of giving them the facts, the bare minimum facts, and letting them dialogue with mom if they needed to. Now I got to ask you, what resources were actually out there for you? Because I know that you wrote this book, Are Enough Resources for Male Partners?
Okay, so my background, I'm an artsy person. I grew up doing musical theater. I cook. I'm still the one that mostly cooks and cleans around the house. I often joke about this to people. I say, yeah, my wife makes more money than I do, but it's okay. I still wear the pants in the family. It's just she buys them for me. And so I don't fit that typical type A masculine type person. I was artsy. I'm a little bit of a geek. I like video games and Star Wars and comic books. So when I started looking for resources, either what I found was from a female perspective, which didn't help me feel any more masculine. So I just felt more emasculated and more feminine in traditional standards. And so I once again, it felt like I was less than a man because of what my wife had done. Or the resources I found were extremely clinical or academic, and they made me feel like a case study rather than a person that was hurting. And so there was a level of sympathy without empathy. Or I did find one resource, and it was so hyper-masculine that it bordered on misogyny. And it was more focused on my wife had an affair, let me tell you how I got her back and how I reclaimed my masculinity. And I'm like, I don't want to be a CrossFit guy. I don't want to work out like that. I don't want to chop logs. And, you know, I want to be me. And all these resources were just reinforcing that I was less than a man and I wasn't good enough. And that's why she did it. Now, that's early on in the process. Obviously the counseling and the more research and finding tools have helped me to separate who I am from her addiction. But yeah, it was just, everything was so emasculating. I was like, okay, is there a book out there, a resource for a man who wants to stay with his spouse, who deeply loves their spouse despite all of this, wants to find a way forward, and yet is okay not being the hyper man, this hyper masculinity. And so I felt like I wrote from a conversational viewpoint, asked some questions at the end of each chapter so somebody could process and think through these chapters and these issues, but trying to do it in a conversational way. So sharing enough of my story, but not making it completely biographical, sharing enough tools, but recognizing the limitations of I'm not a counselor. So just sharing some of the things that I experienced, what worked for me, the feelings I had, and I tried to cover a lot of things that I dealt with personally, and I tried to create the kind of tool I wish I had had on day one.
Well, I love that. I love that you have really made a difference in the lives of others. Share with me how you and the relationship with your wife are doing now that you've had several years into it, correct?
Right. We are 6 years in, and I would say the last year has been the best year. I had a friend ask, one of the friends, and he said, how are you guys doing? And I said, good, as far as I know. And that is the thing that I'm still waiting to shake, is the as far as I know. What I can tell you is the way she was hiding, she's not hiding. The way she was lying, she's not lying. So there are things that she does to help me. And there have been times I've said, hey, you know, this person, they posted that, this guy posted on you. I think that's really inappropriate. Well, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that would be a fight. You know, well, that's just the way guys are. He doesn't mean anything by it. And so it really felt like defending him. And now it's like, oh, okay, I'll block him. There's no resistance. There's no argument. It's, I know it's going to bother you. Let's get rid of him because you're more important than this interaction on Facebook. Little things like leaving her phone out, where before the phone was attached to her everywhere all the time, and now she'll go in another room and leave her phone where I'm at for 10 minutes, and it may not sound like a lot, but it's like, whoa. If she was messing around, somebody could text. Somebody could. I have her Facebook password. I have her Facebook Messenger. So there are things that she's doing that not only show remorse, but really show that she's trying to do this for her as well as me. That it's not just I'm putting on a show to make you feel better. It's I'm very remorseful about what I did. I'm going to try and do everything I can to make you feel safe in this. So I would say, you know, right now we are doing well. I think she's doing really well. She's doing all the things that in counseling I asked and that are expected of her as far as accountability and safety. So I would say we're doing well. you know, do I still have thoughts? Yeah. Yeah, because I'm human. The scary thing is that she has those thoughts too, because she's a human addict. You know, that she still is going to struggle and, you know, and mess up. She hasn't had a relapse in over a year, and so that has been great. So I feel good about where we are right now. I feel realistic about it.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And, you know, you also sound like you have moved into post-traumatic growth, which is what APSATS considers the third stage of partner betrayal. The first stage is safety and stabilization, when you do all that detective work and you're trying to put the pieces together and you're trying to figure out who am I living with and what just happened to me. The second stage is grief and anger, mourning and loss, and you go through all that because, you know, you wonder what kind of a relationship you really had and whether you're ever going to be able to recoup from what happened to you and even build a stronger life. And so that post-traumatic growth is when you realize that you can give back, there are things that you can do, and that you're stronger as a result. And so I'm going to ask you, how do you believe you've changed from all this, and how might you be stronger?
I am quicker to reach out to friends. I'm naturally an introvert, but I am much faster to reach out to friends. In fact, the two friends that I talk to the most, I said to one of them one time, I said, you know, I got to admit, I haven't been the best friend. And the one person replied and goes, yeah, you're right, you haven't. So just being able to be honest and to receive honest feedback has been a big change, that I don't close myself off. I've tried to get out more and be with friends and be with other people. So that has been a big change for me. Another has just been in communication, of being able to say, this bothers me, or I want, so that instead of the old MO of I'm going to get quiet and get mad, it's, no, I'm going to say, this is what I need. This is what I'm feeling. Help me out here. So that's been a big change. The other is just seeing her as a fallible person. And I really did think I married like the perfect woman. You know, she was, it turned out she was legalistic, religiously legalistic. And that was driving her nuts. And so now it's like, okay, I'm going to let my wife be a person rather than a perfection. The other thing, and I know it sounds weird, but I don't know that I could care less. And I think that speaks to the side of me. I hated when people said codependency. I hated that, and I still hate it to an extent. But I understood that, yeah, I was allowing my wife to control my feelings about me and about my world. And so when I say I could not care less, that's actually progress for me. It's saying, you know what? If my wife doesn't like this, that's fine. That's fine. She's not going to like everything about me. She's not going to like all my choices. That's fine. As long as I'm doing it out of a place of identity rather than trying to be mean. And then I think the other big thing is how many people have contacted me or talked to me and said, you know what? We're struggling. My wife and I, were struggling. And I don't know what to do, or even being able to talk to people and say, you know what, go talk to a counselor. It's okay. Nobody, we're not going to think less of you. None of us are perfect. And I think that is one of the biggest pieces of growth, is just allowing people to be imperfect.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, again, you are in no way responsible for your wife's choices, but to take those expectations off of her and to accept her humanness and to accept your own shows real emotional maturity and growth. I mean, that's what we're all striving for. And one of my favorite sayings is, if my intentions are pure, what you think of me is none of my business. Because if I'm doing the next right thing and you don't like it, or you've got an opinion, or, you know, you're going to criticize me, I prefer not to hear it because I'm doing the best that I can.
Yep. Yep. That's absolutely. I mean, there are times I'm a teacher and I've had to say to my students, listen, I know I said a 1 week turnaround, but life is really crazy right now and it's going to take me a few more days. And where before I would stay up all night just to meet an expectation that I don't know they really cared about. You know, so yeah, it's I would never wish this on anybody, and I wish I didn't have to go through it. I wish I didn't have to write this book. I'm glad that I was able to take a terrible circumstance and hopefully help a lot of other men with the questions that they have and the experiences they have, and to know that their situation is not unique, and that if they want to stay, they can stay. That recovery is absolutely possible. And I did not think that was possible 3 years ago.
Okay. And so now we have to end, and I want you to tell everybody how they can get the book, because we're an organization that treats partners, and we want male partners to get more support. So how can they obtain your book?
Yeah, it's on Amazon.com. It's self-published, but it's called The Betrayed Husband Survival Guide. The Betrayed Husband Survival Guide, Gary Owens, and you can do paperback on demand or Kindle. And, you know, I told my counselor, like, I'm not trying to make money from this, so I've got it literally as cheap as I can with the paperback. But so it's The Betrayed Husband Survival Guide, Amazon, paperback, or Kindle.
Got it. Well, Gary, I wish you the most success. You really are growing exponentially, and
I know
it's a day at a time when it comes to relationships, but I do couples counseling and coaching, and I really believe that when two people are working towards healing, it's anything's possible. So just keep up the good work, because I can hear that you're really working on you.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Oh, I appreciate it. And come on the show anytime. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. All right. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. So as you can see, you know, he had a riveting story, and he's been through a lot, and it really hurts, and you can tell he's growing from it, and that's exactly what we have to do. Whenever there's a tragedy that strikes, we have to look at ways that we can find triumph. I'm Carol, the coach, here for appsats.org, and if you're looking for a partner, sensitive, clinician, or coach, go to our directory. That is on appsats.org, APSATS.org, and look for Find a Therapist or a Coach, put in your state or your zip code, and see who's available to work with you face-to-face or who you might be able to work with through telehealth. Hey, listen, there will only be one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. We'll see you next week for more Betrayal Recovery Radio.